Hi, and welcome to another rocking and merciless episode of The Cyber Show. Today, I'm with Andy and Ed, and also with psychotherapist Kate and a number of our favourite guests. And we're tearing apart and hopefully very lovingly putting back together one of our favourite things here on The Cyber Show, the UK Online Safety Bill. It is going to help protect our children. Who does it really benefit? Safety for who, from what, and to what end? Let's take a look. Do people know what the Online Safety Bill is?
So, best way to find out, let's ask some people. We sent our most tenacious investigative reporter out to sniff the air.
Can you answer some questions?
We can answer some questions for you.
Are you a mummy?
Yes, I am a mummy.
Are you a mummy?
I am a mummy.
Are you a mummy?
Yes.
Have you heard of the Online Safety Bill?
I haven't heard of it, no.
Governments are making it.
What are they making it for?
To protect children.
That sounds like a very good idea.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Are you a mummy or a daddy?
A mummy.
Are you a mummy?
Yes, I am.
Have you heard of the Online Safety Bill?
No, I haven't.
Do you know what it's for?
Well, if it's an online safety bill, is it to do with online internet safety? To keep children safe online?
Yes. Is that a good idea?
I think it's a very good idea.
How old are you?
Hello.
Have you heard of the Online Safety Bill?
Yes. It's for protection.
Is that a good idea?
Yes.
Are you a mummy or a daddy?
I'm a mummy.
Online safety bill.
No, I haven't. I'd have to find out more about it, but it sounds pretty good.
I'm a daddy, yeah.
Have you heard of the Online Safety Bill?
I have heard about the Online Safety, yes.
What is it for?
It's to keep our children safe when they use the internet.
Is that a good idea?
That's a brilliant idea.
Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.
I am a mummy.
Have you heard of Online Safety?
I haven't.
It's when you protect kids.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Are you a mummy or a daddy?
A mummy.
Have you heard of the Online Safety Bill?
No.
It's where you protect people on the internet.
Oh, okay.
Is that a good idea?
Yes, very good idea.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Both. I'm a mum and he's a
dad. I'm a dad.
Have you heard of the Online Safety Bill?
Oh, I haven't.
No, I haven't heard about it.
No, I haven't. No.
It's to protect the children online from baddies on it.
Oh, that's a very good idea.
That is a brilliant idea.
Is that a good idea?
Yes.
Thank you.
That's so good.
Are you a mummy or a daddy?
I'm a mummy. He's a daddy.
Have you heard of the Online Safety Bill?
I have. Yes, I have.
Tell me what it is.
It's to try and keep children safe online when they're using the computers.
Is that a good idea?
Yes, it's a very good idea because there's lots of nasty people online.
Yeah.
Not all children understand that.
Thank you very much.
That's all right.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you help me with my project?
Of course, I'd love to.
Are you a mummy or daddy?
No.
Have you heard Online Safety Bill?
No.
Well, it's when people get on their computers, when baddies come on it, and to protect children.
That sounds like a wonderful project.
Do you think it's a good idea?
I think it's a wonderful idea. I think it's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, is that your microphone?
Would you help me with my project?
What's your project about?
It's about the Online Safety Bill. Have you heard of it?
The Online Safety Bill? No.
When you stop children from getting hurt on their computers from baddies.
Yeah. I know about that.
Is that a good idea?
Very good idea. Lots of children have access to lots of computers and phones all the time, and it can be very dangerous.
Yeah.
I'm a mum, and I'm a grandmum.
Have you heard Online Safety Bill?
No, I haven't heard about that. Can you tell me about it?
It's where you keep people safe on their computers.
From bad people on the computers. Well, that sounds very useful.
Do you think it's a good idea?
It sounds like a very good idea to me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Seems people are a little confused. or maybe not so well informed. In fact, 80% of all the people we asked never heard of the online safety bill, yet 90% thought it sounded like a good idea, with only a few sceptical voices saying, "I'd need to know more." Seems like a catchy name alone is sufficient to convince most people. The most well-informed group seems to be children between 10 and 16.
Well, the names of parliamentary bills often have nothing to do with their effect. They're full of partisan language and jumbles of acronyms, right?
Yeah, but let's not be naive. This is a fairly normal political dog whistle.
To add last-minute tag-ons and embed draconian land grabs inside fluffy-sounding legislation.
Totally. And it's a topic that we're all passionate about. Long overdue, and we are big supporters. But then it's definitely getting used as a vehicle for something else, right?
Right, and the subterfuge seems more sophisticated and devious than normal.
Well, let's talk about the deception. Why isn't the online safety bill a solid and certain good thing? Ed, you looked at some organisations and bodies and what they think of the online safety bill.
Yeah, the NSPCC, a leading child protection organisation, said, "The government's online safety bill will bring in much-needed regulation, but it has been contested by an industry for which children's safety is too often an afterthought." The University of Oxford also said, "At present, the UK bill tries to juggle both content and systems regulation, and as a result, does neither very well. The focus on content takes precedence throughout. This is a major missed opportunity." The Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, a collection of respected, often old, liberal computer scientists who built the internet, called the bill a blueprint for repression around the world. Article 19, who work for free expression without fear and discrimination, described the bill as, quote, "a serious threat to human rights online." The source of the bill itself, the UK Conservative Party, has a significant number of its own critics calling it fundamentally misdesigned. David Davis said its well-intentioned attempts may constitute, quote, "the biggest accidental curtailment of free speech in modern history." So, clearly different opinions, some controversy there. What do you make of that?
I think the only way so many smart people could have so very diverse opinions on it is if there is something contradictory or deceptive going on.
Exactly. Some people are reacting to the aims and spirit of the bill, which is in its name. Others are reacting to the details and the likely very negative effects of implementing it badly. You know, it's actually something they wrote in the US Congress. The name of a bill may have nothing to do with what's in it.
Do we have that in the UK?
Well, in the US, there's almost required Orwellian tradition that bills have exactly the opposite meaning as their name. So, like, Press Freedom Bill is to curb the rights of journalists, and so on.
But here, too, I mean, we have that surely, like the Criminal Justice Bill, for example. When you actually read it, it was all about breaking up parties with music of a beat-like repetitive nature. Actually, it should have been called the Miserable Bastards Bill or the Anti-Fun Bill or something.
But I think it's honest. The Online Safety Bill, I mean.
Really? I mean, I agree. We support online safety. We're all about that. But why do you think it's honest if it's mired in so much controversy?
Honest in its aims?
Yeah, in what it sets out to attack.
But then its methods are wrong. They end up hurting all the wrong people, even the people it wants to help.
Children?
Yes, absolutely. It harms children if it's implemented wrong. It can actually make things worse because its methods, its implementation is broken. There's no other way to politely put it. The right to anonymity and privacy applies to children too. And indeed, anonymity and privacy may be the most powerful weapons they have to protect themselves in the long term from a broader range of harms.
I think the people who crafted this are out of their depth intellectually. They are unqualified technically and politically to see how it will actually play out. I know it sounds arrogant, but I mean, we're being charitable by saying that in some ways, right? The only other interpretation is that they're malicious. They want the bill to fail or to harm our country or harm the children. And I don't believe for a moment that that's true. I have a cynical, paranoid hypothesis, if you'll hear me out, that the late edition surveillance clauses to the online safety bill are designed to torpedo the bill, making it so unacceptable and destructive to the social fabric and the economy of the country, such an affront to common sense, that those additions are designed to make it unworkable. And once it's failed, ensure that nothing like it ever gets put back on the table for another 20 years. So the people who tagged on the anti-encryption stuff at the end really picked their moment. They really want this. They want it badly. And they're cynically prepared to use actual child safety as their risk
check. No, I don't think that's true. The road to hell. But then that's why we're here. To give accessible analysis, to help people see, including politicians, why this stuff is more complicated than it seems.
Well, let's talk about the good sides. Here on The Cyber Show, we support the principles of online safety, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. We've all been saying this stuff for years. Time to limit the exposure of vulnerable people to all sorts of online harms, not just young people, not just the harms they mention.
We know that whole generations, multiple generations now, are totally screwed up by what they experience online. It's robbing people of their attention, focus, their whole lives. All the research is in, and it's scary. It's making people stupid, afraid, unable to have proper relationships. It's leading to really scary resilience and social order threats.
Sure, like disinformation, like gaslighting entire nations, just enumerating the harms of online. It could be a whole mini-series. So shall we say, as a baseline, all is not well, we all agree, we recognise serious online harms.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, definitely.
So the question is then, what to do about it?
Yeah.
And even though regulation should be a last resort, we've got to that last resort because big tech wouldn't play it grown up.
Yeah, for like about 20 years.
And the online safety bill is something we like and support.
Yeah, right. Kind of.
Okay, but they broke it and tried to tag on a load of weird fascist stuff, and now it's at risk. And in some ways, the harms the government want to inflict are worse than the harms of just leaving things alone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's a central premise that some place exists called online. And it can be made safe. I mean, is that even true?
Can it?
Or what is online? Mm. TikTok, Facebook, sure. Or the private messages your parents send you, things you do at school, or interactions with your doctors about a potential pregnancy. That's not public online. That's my online.
Like when I send you a private email, end-to-end encrypted from my computer to your computer, that has nothing to do with this government's conception of online, does it?
No, I think by online, the government mean our upstart enemies in big tech. The wording specifically invokes platforms. That doesn't cover my emails to my accountant or our private chat group, for example, does it?
But the government wants to attack end-to-end encryption. And end-to-end encryption really only makes sense in the context of one-to-one, one-to-small-n communications. Social media platforms are end-to-end, and that's where the real harms are happening, as mass effects. So I don't think the government understand basic computer science and communications theory.
There's a question of scope and definitions. I think currently this is aimed towards big tech platforms, Google, Facebook, whatever, but it's clumsy and gauche.
Yeah, but then mission creep? Isn't this another wedge to attack all private communication? That's not a price to pay for anyone's safety. That my kids are safe, for what? To grow up into a world that's not worth living in? Because everybody's words are monitored and a chilling effect means that nobody has anything to say anymore. No thanks. And how are they going to enforce a ban on TLS and SSH? Shut down the entire web for online shopping? Stop you logging into your bank securely?
So, at the moment, it seems limited to so-called tech platforms. And the big stick here is to make executives personally liable.
What, with jail time?
Yeah, with a 2-year sentence if they flaunt calls for them to provide proper duty of care to children.
And fines as well?
£18 million, or 10% of profit.
That sounds great. I hate big tech. They ruin computing, they ruin society, they act like they own the world. I say, come down on them like a ton of bricks.
But you're missing the point. It doesn't stop there, does it? It's not limited to big tech. They're the start. That's where a bill like this gets traction. because, as you say, you hate big tech.
Whoa, hate's a big word, bro.
You said it.
Did I?
This is a hate speech, literally. I'm going to have to report you both for harms.
Guilty as charged. Okay, let me be more nuanced then and careful. Given the means and the opportunity and the capability to utterly destroy Google, Facebook, Amazon, you know, just a giant red button that would wipe them out of history, I'd press it in a heartbeat. Not saying that anyone else should think that or act on that, but, you know, nuke Google, just saying.
Sorry, seriously, your point is that you're not alone. What did The Economist call it? The techlash? That was back in 2017, right? Or earlier, maybe? People know it now. They know big tech has too much power. The exec came over here.
Came over here with their fancy Silicon Valley ways.
Thumbed his nose at our parliament.
Yeah, sure. They relish them for being taken down a peg.
Yeah.
We all do now. The mob is ready for some burning.
Oh, yeah.
Hell yeah.
Massive fines for tech execs.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Justice for the people.
And tear it down.
Destroy it.
Okay, and the government are happy to leverage opinions like mine against big tech to get justice, to make them a scapegoat, even though they are guilty of profiting from misery and harms.
That's the rub, isn't it? They brought this on themselves.
And we all like a strong man, right? Tough on crime.
A woman.
Oh?
Yeah, Nadine Dorries is the new pitbull. She really wants Zuck's blood.
Good for her.
But is attacking big tech the answer?
I think they want to do multiple things. Some of them contradict. They don't all agree. Be seen to be protecting children, giving the evidence of mental health issues. Be seen, even if protection can't reasonably be achieved this way. There's a lot of PR and perception management at play. In that way, they're protecting big tech.
For starters, I think they need to up their game in their rational evidence-based shit. Like, you know, here's the science-y bit. So they wheeled out Michelle Donnellan, UK Secretary for Technology, with a degree in history and politics and a career in marketing. And she wants to tell us all about what's necessary. I'm sorry, love. As a woman in tech, you're not speaking to me that way. You want to talk to me about cipher algorithms, key escrow, pseudonymous identity models? Fine, I'm all ears. But don't you presume to tell me what you think is or you think is not necessary with your marketing credentials. To someone who thinks returning the Parthenon marbles to Greece would open a can of worms and be a dangerous road to go down, I'd like to say she has no idea what a fucking can of worms or a dangerous road even looks like.
Whoa, go easy on her. I think she's been stood up, Liz Truss-styly, all over again. Actually, Boris Johnson did this to her already, put her in an impossible position as the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
It lasted 36 hours. It's the shortest-serving political position in British history. If I were her, I'd resign right away and say, sorry, I won't embarrass myself by pretending to know what this bill is really about and be made a fool of.
It makes me angry. We all supported the bill for years. Now they're sneaking dodgy last-minute shit in. That's got nothing to do with the real objectives. And they take us all for fools. Why do we have deceptive bills before Parliament at all? Why aren't governments even just a little bit honest about the proposals, about what they really want to do?
I think they want to do multiple things. Some of them contradict. They don't all agree.
And some of them are blatantly fascist in nature, and reasonable people would just shoot them down if they understood. Also, there's a bitter power struggle. They want and need to assert power against big tech. I mean, that's long overdue, something I stand by. Governments have started to look weak against big tech. We've needed to take a stick to Silicon Valley for some time now, but I don't think this madness is the right way to go.
Be seen to be protecting children, giving the evidence of mental health issues. Be seen, even if protection can't reasonably be achieved this way. There's a lot of PR and perception management at play. In that way, they're protecting big tech. Mm.
And to ratchet more control. I mean, let me be cynical. All governments tend towards tyranny unless checked. All governments want more legibility. And the Tories have been in too long. They're getting a little bit dictatory.
They want to spy on people, and any opportunity they get, this is a good opportunity to trample more civil rights.
Lots of other countries are watching the UK right now to see how this goes. Are we going to get away with it? Authoritarianism is on the rise globally. We've all lost our way, I think. As defenders of freedom and liberal democracy, I feel like one of the last holdouts.
Okay, but let's take things on face value for now. Let's at least pretend the bill is built on only good intentions.
Okay, sure, I can play happy families.
Yeah, seems like a good place to start. Let's play happy families. Well, here's my theory. Imagine there's two bills. One that tackles the root causes at a societal level, but it's messy and awkward. And the other one, it just does some magic in the cloud, you know, and somehow fixes everything with a magic cloud algorithm or whatever.
For awkward, you mean things like children under 16 should not even be allowed smartphones?
Well, exactly.
Things like that. Much more controversial.
Hard things. Things that really go against the tide. Things that challenge growth, control, and the very rights of government to dictate how we should live our digital lives.
Yeah.
Things that people like Tristan Harris, Bruce Schneier, Johan Hari, writers like Cory Doctorow and Charlie Brooker would be all about. Building a safe technological society is a damn sight more difficult than simply spying on every kid's communications.
Yeah, but that should be more controversial, right?
But that's not how it seems to work. People are selfishly, well, self-interested, just me, me, me. Look at Labour losing the by-election because of green policies. People want other people to give up their cars, not themselves. And if the government spy on kids or get big tech to do it for them, then it's somebody else's kids, not mine, because my kids are good kids. But if I had to take the phone off my own seven-year-old, well, that's way too close to home.
The problem is you just voted in fascism because you're too scared to challenge your own toddler.
But people don't see that. They don't understand what's actually being done. The politicians who wrote it don't understand. So how could your mum or your granny or the kids, how can anyone know or vote with informed consent?
So I guess we're saying that a lack of controversy comes about because of ignorance. People don't know what they're really voting for. And that's why we get these deceptive bills, because they will slide in more easily.
That ignorance is lube. Except it's not, though, is it? I mean, there's already a backlash. Some people kind of noticed them sneaking up behind with a great big... what's happening there, Ed?
Okay, so let's talk about big tech opposition to UK online safety bill. A few weeks ago, Apple publicly warned that the bill poses, quote, a serious threat by undermining end-to-end encryption, which they call, quote, critical capability and protection. Without changes to protect strong end-to-end for everyone, Apple thinks the bill puts UK citizens, quote, at greater risk.
I agree with Apple there.
So the whole safety aspect of the legislation, its central claim and title, is a contradiction?
Yeah, totally.
Of course, big tech players would say stuff like this. The bill is mainly aimed at them. It's going to hurt profits. Just so you know, this is my surprise voice. So why should we believe them any more than the empty trust us statement that governments make?
Totally.
But it's not just obviously self-interest companies, is it? The computer science world has been up in arms too. Tell us about that, Andy.
Well, in an open letter, hundreds of UK-based security and privacy experts have now warned that the proposed legislation is a direct and dangerous threat to security technologies that we use to keep digital communications safe. So that's using your bank, protecting your health records, talking to your accountant or financial advisor. Also, any aspect of business, strategy, trade secrets, negotiations. The problem is, from a technical perspective, the online safety bill threatens online safety.
Yeah.
The safety of our information. Information which we have a sacred, inviolable right to preserve the confidentiality of. At least under anything that even resembles a non-fascist government. These inconvenient little conceits, you know, privacy and dignity.
But the online safety bill drafters will say that it doesn't include these things, surely.
Of course, they'll say that, that they're lying. It does include these things by mission creep. The drafters of the online safety bill believe that one way to achieve their aims is to attack end-to-end encryption. It's a misguided attempt to protect children. They also believe in insane ideas like client-side scanning.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to start with what a totally mad and tyrannical idea that is and all the ways that it's going to go horribly wrong. It's real batshit, Dr. Evil, cat-stroking, secret island-based stuff.
No, Mr. Zuckerberg, I expect you to die.
So, yeah, a massive petition from professors like me went to the Lords last week, from people like Ross Anderson at Cambridge, King's, UCL and Oxford. It described, quote, extremely alarming misunderstandings and misconceptions around the idea of online safety, about the relation between privacy and security, about the workings of the technology and the nature of our daily online interactions on which society relies. Basically, they're saying, hold it, step away from the internet. You really don't know what you're doing.
It's a bit arrogant, but they are right.
Yeah, I hear you, but they are right, sadly. The bill has a heart of gold in its intentions, but it's utterly clueless and dangerous in its methods. The problem is, you can't achieve online safety through a contradiction. Let me cite you a little bit more. The letter goes on to point out that systematic routine monitoring of people's private digital communications is categorically incompatible with today's communication protocols and the technological society that we're building on them. I mean, that's pretty damning, and I would like to say it in plainer English than my colleagues might use, because they are academics with positions to preserve, and I'm kind of past that now. The people who drafted this stuff are a few bulbs short of a full set of Christmas tree lights. Not very bright. There's a competence gap here, or the wrong people are advising them. We can't expect members of parliament to hold a PhD in cryptology, right? But when the only advisers they listen to have an a priori interest in destroying confidentiality and free speech, then we've got a serious problem. More to the point, I'd kind of like to know who these people are. I mean, where do politicians get these ideas from? There's not much transparency around it. Either they're being left to their own devices and wandering off into the woods, or they're being led astray. Either way, that's quite scandalous, and a failure of the legislature. The online safety bill seems to have been crafted in an academic vacuum.
Harsh words. OK, well, now might be a good time, right, to get into the bill a bit. A very quick summary. Bit of history. The bill starts in 2019 as Online Harms White Paper under Theresa May. Among its main aims at the time are 1. Age checks for pornography sites. 2. Clamping down on anonymous trolls by requiring stronger identity. 3. Criminalising sending of unsolicited nudes via social media apps. And 4. Tackling scam advertisements.
And since then, it's been through like 5 or 6 revisions, I think.
They keep adding stuff and taking some away again.
Dividing by the number you first thought of.
Yeah, and now we've got a real mess, because it's on like the third reading and still full of serious weaknesses that will be ridiculously hard to fix at this late stage.
Like what? Hit us with some?
Okay. Ways to tackle lawful but awful speech and images that are merely distasteful but legal. That one got shot down. Tougher rules are needed to target misogyny. Measures to better tackle grooming. Upskirt and down blouse, covert pervy photography.
Amen to those.
That online platforms can be ordered by the government to use accredited technology to identify child images. That's one of the most controversial.
Yeah, that's where the wheels really fall off. Trying to turn very well-meaning declarative intent into imperative machinery. That's legislative overreach right there. And the overreach is in the absence of any understanding or good advice. That's where it's egregious.
And there's also the US version, the Kids Online Safety Act. So there's some lining up of things happening.
Yeah, I think the pressure's been building for some time, and for so long in the US too, because of their misbehaviour, because of their power. Big tech has goaded the wrath of government. It's going to get interesting.
So let's define some harm. So there's lots of good stuff in there, in my opinion. Fuck the misogynists and pervs taking photos on public, even though I'm more worried about who's on the other end of that CCTV camera looking down my front, to be honest. Where does it go so wrong? It's all about the methods, right?
Yeah.
About the methods.
There's one big problem right from the get-go. Letting the state define what counts as harmful is a bad road to travel down. It is abundantly clear from research that smartphones and social media are harmful in a major way to individuals and society at large. But Do we want governments to ban those things? I don't think so. It has to come from the people. Do we want governments to help people manage these things by providing an alternative to those who don't want their lives ruled by invasive mandated technologies? Most definitely. But I don't see that approach, or even any recognition of such harms, or other possible solutions. They're not represented in this bill. Or even the idea that people should help defend themselves. Digital self-defense, civic cybersecurity, to empower teachers, parents, the kids themselves. Where is that? Government have a perception blind spot around the idea that solving technological problems can be done by informing and empowering people.
Yeah, it takes on an a priori stance that the harms are caused by the types of content, not that the harms might be a result of the technology itself. So I see something a little bit sinister here. For example, it's becoming more acceptable for parents to say, sorry, I don't want my kid using a laptop or a tablet at school, and the teachers are pretty cool with that right now. And that's right. I mean, I think it's a right that every parent should have to say, I don't want my kid's brain and eyes being ruined by 8 hours screen time a day. Get some damn pens and books out already. But now we kind of get to the, oh, well, hey, the UK's the safest place in the world to be online. So what's the problem? The problem is not the content, not the message. The problem is the medium, because the medium is the message. The problem is the normalising of online in the first place. That is the online harm.
Good point. Yeah, countries that want to force a technological society on people are kind of obliged to at least try to secure it. That deflects any objections, because right now, the state of cybersecurity, that's a knockdown argument in favour of anyone who says, no thanks, not for me.
Exactly. I will never carry a smartphone so long as they are basically what they are, a pre-compromised tracking and surveillance device. No amount of assurance is going to fix that for me. They'd have to force me at gunpoint. But children, they don't have the same agency. They're pliable, malleable. They don't exercise rational, informed choice in the same way. They don't have the capacity. So they're weak and vulnerable. So technology has become a very dangerous medium to manipulate the youngest generations. And all the power players want a piece of your kids. The government too.
And what harms you may not harm me. Or not in the same way, or to the same degree.
Yeah, sound philosophy. It's a problem that's as old as John Stuart Mill or even Aristotle. As free adults, it's up to people to make up their own choices around harms. Anything else is a nanny state.
Certainly, governments could better help with legislation, giving a framework, one, that empowers people to make and enforce their own choices. Like, should parents be involved with the choices that their children make online in those early stages? For example, could they set up a Pornhub account for their horny teenage boy to limit some of the harms that they may be exposed to without doing that last step? With the choice to disable any monitoring or blocking when they're ready to extend a little bit more trust to their young adults. Because a few years later, they're 18, they're at university, they've got a laptop in their bedroom, and the whole world is their oyster. Surely we have to guide them in their few years before then to make the right choices online.
Absolutely. But the bill seems to carry with it a huge amount of moralistic prejudgment about the constitution of harms. By the same token, it neglects many other grievous harms, ones that don't fit into the Western Anglo-Saxon Protestant value set.
It misses that advertising in general is super toxic as an industry and is a menace to society. Your girls are more likely to end up with obesity, anorexia, or body dysmorphia because of fast food and the beauty industry. Adverts made by PhDs in psychology who turn their powers to evil to manipulate kids. Yeah, nice look.
It neglects monopoly too. The lack of competition, broken intellectual property laws, and rights management systems that curtail knowledge. The walled gardens, the lack of interoperability, the data mining, and the non-consensual tracking. They're all egregious harms visited on every internet user. The story is in what's missing. What the government doesn't think or isn't prepared to admit is a online harm.
So it's this selectivity that is troubling.
Maybe what it comes down to is something we've already analysed here on the Cyber Show. the problem of enumerating harms.
Reminder to listeners, you can find that episode in our mini-series, The Six Dumbest Ideas in Computer Security, analysing Marcus Renum's paper.
Thanks, Helen. So yeah, a bill that sets out by defining harms will always be incomplete, or it will overreach. Either way, that's a problem. And we see it in the evolution of the bill, as it's passed through four successive governments. For example, clauses dealing with legal but harmful content were scratched from the bill in 2022. A so-called harmful communications offence covering messages that caused, quote, serious distress, that was knocked out.
Yeah, but these remain some of the most awful harms. I mean, messages deliberately designed to psychologically damage the recipient or to promote suicide or self-harm, but they can't readily be pinned down. And in some other contexts, well, they're just part of the fun of normal adult banter.
Oh, come on, Andy. If you seriously think that, then why don't you just go jump off the pier?
Exactly. So critics feared the criminalising of offensive but legal speech. And they were right. No doubt those provisions would get misused to silence political speech, righteous outrage, protest all sorts of other speech, anything designated as hateful or harmful, but totally essential to a working liberal democracy.
So we start from some very serious fundamental problems.
Yeah, that if we cannot define harms in a useful way, how can we hope to build legislation around that? Okay, let's dig into the faults of implementation. The next major problem is with how they want to achieve any of this. What is the main mechanism by which our legislators hope to address these ill-defined harms? Turns out that's even worse than the first problem.
Yeah, there are basically two key technical provisions, both of which the government want to foist upon digital service providers. Notice, not on the sources of harm and not on the recipients and the victims of the harms, by way of help or laws that strengthen consumers' ability to self-defend, to prosecute or to seek compensation. No, what they've done is they put the onus entirely on the platform service providers. So as such, the bill is not an engagement with the harms per se, or the effects of the harms, but on the communication apparatus itself that's used to facilitate the harms. It's actually much more meta than it seems. So one of the mechanisms is to weaken encryption. The other is to insert backdoors in the form of highly controversial and dangerous client-side scanners. And eventually we'll see AI get into this and their presence on people's devices. Both of them are ways to weaken security. And as cybersecurity professionals, that should worry us all greatly. Let's deal with the backdoors first. Helen, can you explain to the listeners, what is a backdoor?
So a backdoor is a deliberate hidden design flaw. It allows a secret code for getting into your device. It bypasses all the security settings that you have. An attacker can get in silently, anytime, read or steal your files, change your settings, or even put new files in there, and they leave no trace. Not just that, it is a way of doing so remotely. The attacker does not have to touch your phone, but can get in through the wireless network at any time. Even more alarming is that the same code works for all devices. Think of it as a blueprint for a master key that allows a locksmith or the police to get into your house and all the neighbours' houses at once. Such a thing is so immensely powerful and ripe for abuse that all ethical computer scientists and programmers are sworn never to make one or help anyone else to make one. Some totalitarian governments, like in China, already force them into devices. In liberal democracies, we consider this repugnant and a violation of human rights. That's why the USA, under President Biden, banned all products made by Huawei. Once a backdoor is in a device, it can never be trusted again. It must be thrown out. The ecological impact of this alone is catastrophic. Think of the environmental cost of trashing billions of handsets. It is also a death sentence for the reputation of a company. Cisco used to supply half of all the routers on the internet. until back doors were found in its products. Today, the company struggles to hold on to 6% of the market it created. Through the online safety bill, our own governments are foolishly eyeing back doors as a solution to the ambitious social aims they've committed to. All the smartest computer scientists agree that to allow that to happen would mean the end of digital technology as we know it. The aims of the online safety bill are laudable, vital, and a change we desperately need to safeguard the future of our children. But the proposed methods are simply insane.
But that's only half of it. Some people think that backdoors can be used responsibly. They follow the same logic as those who think nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons of mass destruction can be responsibly maintained as a deterrent. Let's be clear, backdoors are a cyber weapon. Some people think that cyber weapons can be deployed in a measured and controllable way against the population, our own population, and that nothing bad will happen because responsible people are in charge. They're wrong. And it's this misguided belief that's at the heart of why the Online Safety Bill, as written, is a looming disaster for Western democracy. Helen, why can't people keep secrets?
Oh, well, I can keep a secret, if you can, listeners. Here's one. No credible government, computer scientists, believe weakening encryption or mandating client-side backdoors for scanning are a viable idea. Shh. Backdoors are the ultimate secret, a source of immense power. Anyone that knows the backdoor code, whether they're a legitimate police investigator or a cyber criminal or a jealous stalker who wants to physically harm you, they get the same access. In security engineering, the wisdom is, quote, two people can keep a secret if one of them is dead. That's another way of saying there are no such things as secrets. On a long enough timeline, all secrets are revealed, especially if those secrets are a source of immense power. Secrets that are merely a source of shame fare better. So it's good if your government at least pretends it's a liberal democracy and is ashamed of any backdoors it knows about. But now we're talking about a government that wants to openly insert backdoors into products. So here's how the story goes. The number of people who know how to exploit a backdoor will start out small, and then it will grow and grow and grow. Soon, for the convenience of lower-ranking, unskilled officers, we'll start to create easy-to-use scripts and tools allowing anyone without any technical knowledge to hack your phone. To begin with, these will all be guarded under grave threats. But lower-ranking officials are poorly paid, or they change jobs, or they're seduced by a sexy cyber criminal or foreign agent because they are not vetted, trained, and supervised. Secret codes get taken home on laptops. Laptops get lost on trains or stolen. Files often get left at bus stops. Or just maybe, if every single person in your organisation is perfect, is conscientious and careful and loyal, your systems still get hacked because someone else, well-meaning of course, put into your system, you know, that backdoor thing. You get the picture. Soon, backdoor codes will flood the market. This demonstrably always happens exactly as I've described, without fail, without exception. Secrets are subject to entropy, and anyone who thinks differently has no understanding of craft and security thinking. It's just a matter of time.
Let's have a look at a couple of examples of backdoors. I mean, how bad can this get, Ed?
Well, one example recently is three Dutch security analysts discovered the vulnerabilities, five in total, in a European radio standard called TETRA, which stands for Terrestrial Trunked Radio, which is used in radios made by Motorola, DAM, Hytra, and others. The standard has been used in the radio since the 90s, but the flaws remained unknown because the encryption algorithms used in TETRA were kept secret until now. This is just one of many backdoors placed in technologies and software. Helen, why don't you mention a couple that you found recently?
So I've got a little list here of some pretty intense backdoors that I've managed to find, and some of them go back quite far, actually. So there's one in particular called Back Orifice, of course. And it's actually considered one of the first kinds of backdoor in history. And it's it was led by the Cult of the Dead Cow.
Very famous hacking group.
It's a very 1998's name. I actually appreciate the names. They're quite cool. So they use back orifice to control and remotely control... the network. They operated in Microsoft back office server. So you're thinking, like, in 1998, people are using quite a lot of that technology. There was a DSL backdoor was discovered in late 2013... by a French reverse engineer. And the backdoor allows an attacker to send commands. They install malware, put a command in, watch your camera, whatever. Steal your data.
Anything they want, basically.
Yeah, basically. And that's the power of the backdoors. And then we've got things like the PGP encryption, whole disk. Oh, yeah, they put a backdoor in the entire whole disk encryption that everyone was using. Right, you're encrypting your disk going, my disk's safe. And it's like, no, because they've literally just left the window open and now they're all fucking climbing in, but never mind. I was really shocked, actually, about how there is a backdoor available in Linux. Luckily, it was stopped last minute. But, someone managed to insert a command and control mechanism, again.
Yes, somebody was trying to actually put that code into the kernel, which is going to be a very likely target, yeah?
Don't forget, also, it was reported that the NSA paid RSA $10 million for the company to design the elliptical curve dual system, a random number generator based on elliptical curves, widely used on the internet, it says. Government-level NSA-sponsored backdoors. So we're not the first country to essentially do that, and we're not going to be the last. But there's a common theme with all of these, is that they're all used to command and control the devices on the other end. So if our governments are putting backdoors in them, surely their real goal there would be to command and control your computer to do whatever the bloody hell they like.
Anything they want, basically. They find more every day. Well, it also reminds me of the backdoor they placed in the official PHP Git repo in 2021, which were apparent minor adjustments, however, enabled the ability to perform remote code execution on any server running PHP.
There seems to me that the problem with backdoors is that they seem a very attractive solution. And for people who don't have a good, deep, solid knowledge of protocols and cryptography and all of the thinking around this, they're a kind of mind trap. They're dumb ideas. They're a mind trap, like a perpetual motion machine. And they seem like a way to shortcut reason. And, you know, you have to accept from the beginning that backdoors are not a possible solution. They are not a possible solution because they will always leak. And they will always leak in the most catastrophic Murphy's Law kind of way. A really big problem lies in the language around this bill and the latent attitude that it reveals within our legislature and government departments. As reported on the TechCrunch website, a quote spokesperson, presumably not a scientist or logician or anything like that, for the Department of Science, Innovation and Technology, made this statement.
We are unambiguously pro-innovation and pro-privacy. However, we have made clear that companies should only implement end-to-end encryption if they can simultaneously prevent abhorrent child sexual abuse on their platforms.
This statement can be reduced logically to A, however, not A. It is not possible in any world, however hard you wish, to be both unambiguously pro-privacy, which requires end-to-end, and also simultaneously demand that the developer control all possible misuses of communication tools. It's simply an unreasonable demand.
It's a way of saying we are very ambiguously anti end-to-end encryption, just as a logical fact. In all systems of logic and reason, since the Greeks have started with something approximate to A implies A, or if A, then A. This is the principle of non-contradiction, possibly the most fundamental linguistic statement that can be made by a human being. In other words, the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology statement is an obvious contradiction. Since I don't believe that that department are that stupid or unable to recruit people versed in the most basic tenets of logic, we have to conclude that the statement's mischievous or deliberately disingenuous. Let's say it in other words.
We are unambiguously pro-woodworking. However, we have made clear that tool companies may only sell hammers and saws if they can simultaneously prevent cut fingers and saw thumbnails.
So what they are saying is, woodworking is simply too much of a risk, and therefore we want all tool makers to stop selling their products. These lawmakers need to go back to the drawing board and realise that end-to-end encryption is basically what runs our economy by underpinning the fundamental security of everything. Sure, ban woodworking tools, but then don't complain when we have no ships in the Navy to fight off an armada.
Let's look at some of the problems a little deeper for a moment. When dealing with erroneous thinking, it's a good idea to get into what we call root cause analysis, to ask why was this a problem, at least five levels deep. Another approach is to ask what other solution, perhaps a simpler or more obvious solution, might have been proffered in place. Let's go back to those four original bugbears in the online harms white paper again.
Number one.
Problem one. The first point is congruous with the war on drugs. Ah, oh, that worked well, didn't it? Teenagers who want porn will get it, end of. By fair means or foul, they will get what they want. By faking their ID, by buying access from an adult, or by hacking the system, by all the myriad services that will spring up to supply access, or by sharing homemade pornography amongst themselves. It's creating another whole layer of criminality, black markets, enforcement costs, and adding new harms. Why don't we start with sex education for primary school kids? Because that's when they start now. To tackle their understanding and appetite for explicit imagery, help them understand what's okay for adults and not okay for kids, why it hurts you, and what normal sex looks like.
Number two.
Trolling is bad, but anonymity is a key good. It's a vital tool for self-development. Anonymity protects children online. More to the point, it protects them from very grave real-world threats to their physical selves. As examples, battered women fleeing abusive spouse or honour killings, adopted children or wards of care, children who may be abducted or be victims of crime, anyone who's at risk if they expose their identity, just to pay for a coffee or shop online, or just very socially anxious individuals. There are millions of people who deserve and have the right to the protections of anonymity. The fact that a few people abuse anonymity is not sufficient grounds to demand that all of civilization should give it up and face even worse potential harms arising from mandated strong online identity. Furthermore, it is not possible to secure every single access portal to the internet or to make communication systems immune to spoofing, any more than it is to stop somebody using a postbox to send something nasty anonymously. It is a protocol-level limitation that allows the internet to work as it does. Again, a determined aggressor, disgruntled employee, spurned ex-lover, or psychotic stalker will find a way to get in and try getting to you. This is baked into the very nature of communication systems. Strong online identity is then itself a grave harm. Anonymity is a key component of privacy and dignity. Strong identity massively amplifies the problems of tracking, stalking, profiling, manipulation, discrimination, blackmail, and potential threats to democracy in favour of fascism. This seems an unreasonable price to pay to solve the problems that some people are upset by the things that other people say. So maybe we should tackle the problem of trolling and other communications intended to psychologically harm others, rather than worrying about anonymity.
Number three.
This is a special case of problem two, except that harmful messaging is an image. And by the way, it doesn't have to be sexual imagery. Much of the disturbing content sent to upset others is gore or simply something disliked by the recipient. Perhaps to provoke a phobia like spiders, snakes, or even clowns. The big problem here is that most of the sexual images sent between parties on the network are consensual. Famously, when the NSA started breaking into people's webcams in the USA, they found the majority of all video communications was sexual camming.
A great deal can be accomplished by intellectual self-defense programs, as implemented in Finland, Sweden, and Estonia, along with much better elective client-side filtering tools that can flag and block potentially hostile messages or images.
Number four.
Problem four, this is the worst of all the points in all of the prototype bill, mainly attempts to categorically define harm as content rather than behaviour or intent. And in that genesis are the bad seeds of its current faults. That's a point we need to come back to in depth because it's an Achilles heel to try dealing with the internet on its surface features. Actual harms occur in context, with intent and complex parameters around them, which make the same content or actions harmless with only slight changes in those parameters. As a lawyer would say, the bill is very much one of letters, not of spirit.
The bill sadly misses a profound technical opportunity for solutions. The legislators propose a so-called triple shield approach. This is welcome and insightful. It's an acknowledgement of the layered nature of the problem and the existence of separate but overlapping spheres of responsibility. The shields are broken into illegal content hosted or sourced by platforms, which it says they must remove. All fair enough. A second shield that says material breaching the platform's own terms of service must be removed. This is kind of do-as-you-say rule that prevents selective removal, which may amount to discrimination or censorship. Actually, I think this is a far-sighted and powerful rule. The third shield says that adult users must be given filters for the content they see.
That last point is both great and problematic. It's not mandating filters or what kinds of selectors those filters might use, but it is placing the responsibility for the design and rollout of the filters within the platform's own system. That seems wrong. It's the problem with platforms as such. All-in-one monolithic apps go against the interoperability principle. Instead, the legislators should mandate the opening of APIs and force interoperability upon the platforms. Something approximate to a standardized secure plugin architecture where users can insert their own or third-party filter modules into the delivery pipeline. That would be really useful. It would allow a market in specialized client-side AI to flag possibly hurtful content, all under the user's control. Of course, it would open the possible security concerns around those plugins, but that's another story. What that does is to shift some of the responsibility for deciding what is, quote, harm, and how to deal with that, onto the user, which is where it belongs.
Okay, let's finish off by talking about mission creep. All roads to hell start out with good intentions that drift off course. A big, big problem in all this technological legislation is creep, or bleed. What you set in motion escapes your control. We just talked about this in the context of backdoors, and we talked about this in our Watchers episode 2, that CCTV has become a scourge in society, a harm in itself, and a cause of the very harms this bill is seeking to address.
When you seek to formalise hitherto secret protocols, pragmatic stuff like, for example, undercover agents may have to commit crime, you very quickly weave a tangled web. Let's actually consider that case. So this was called the Covert Human Intelligence Sources Bill. Let's just call it the James Bond Bill. And it was once proposed and then shot down repeatedly by Labour, who were in opposition at the time. It sought to make undercover operatives immune from criminal culpability.
That's not unconscionable, per se. For example, consider what was once called Crown Immunity. It applied to police, fire, or ambulance drivers who might, tragically, in the course of rushing to an emergency, cause a death or injury. Crown Immunity protected them from ending up in prison for dangerous driving offences. However, after a series of pedestrian fatalities in high-speed police chases, Crown Immunity was repealed. An all-too-familiar consequence. Due to insurance and liability demands, is that our cities are now so noise polluted by vehicle sirens deployed overcautiously or unnecessarily. Anyway, bear that in mind as we explore the following.
Consider the extraordinary example dubbed Raped by the State of the Bob Lambert case. A cop posed as an environmental activist. He dated a woman and had kids with her, lied to her in order to infiltrate her friends, then vanished, abandoning her and the son he fathered, all in the line of duty. The victim suffered psychological harms, successfully sued the police. Lambert is still an academic and obtained an MBE. Lambert personally apologised to his ex-girlfriend.
So I am certain that it would have been massively traumatic for Lambert's partner to find out that the entire basis of her deepest relationship and the paternity of her son was based on deceit. And I think that there is an argument that this being done by the police shows the criminal justice system went out of control. In terms of the motivations of Lambert, he might have felt that he was doing anti-terrorism work, but that this wasn't properly supervised and the Met failed in their duty of care to maybe potentially both Lambert and society in general. But I think that there is something deeper going on about epistemic trust and about how traumatic it is when the emotions involved are that the adults, the people in authority in the room, aren't behaving in a trustworthy manner. And people can find that deeply traumatic. People found that deeply traumatic in the pandemic.
That's a sad story, but covert human intelligence sources was about the right of covert operators to murder, license to kill. So, who should have James Bond powers? MI5? The police? HMRC? Yeah, the tax office. What about the Food Standards Agency? These were all actually listed as agencies that would be covered in the original bill, as agencies that could be made immune from certain laws while discharging their duties. What about the secretary of your local councillor or a random social worker? Nothing against social workers here. They're the salt of the earth and fabric of society and count amongst my friends. But they would, by their own admission, say there's no way that they should hold those kinds of powers. When you have to start making carve-outs like this, it means your whole legislature needs a new broom.
It's a fundamental principle of the rule of law that nobody is above the law. We've upheld that for 7 or 8 centuries, right? So what the hell are we doing making carve-outs so that petty officials can work to a different set of laws than the rest of us? Now it's done in the name of technology, as if technology presents a new and different world in which the rule of law is suspended. So in civic cybersecurity, we've called this digital privilege, and it's a massive, growing problem.
Here's the problem. A kid gets killed because some idiot parked their car on a school zebra crossing. Turns out that person is immune. Turns out that person is a local petty official.
Drainage Inspection Corps, Kitchen Division, D-I-C-K. Step aside, Mum.
Sorry, mate, your dick is not covered.
But my dick is invincible.
You will respect my authority!
No, because it's actually an erosion of authority. It's a paradox authoritarian-minded people don't see easily. In a world where ipso facto everything is X, nothing is X. In a world where everyone is clever, nobody is clever. In a world where everyone is a cop, nobody is a cop. In a world where every petty traffic warden, school inspector, and litter patrol officer has impervious authority, there is no authority. Just arbitrary privilege. As Deckard's boss Bryant says it in Blade Runner, there's cops and there's little people.
The point is that every system, through mission creep and corruption, inevitably spreads and gains more power. If online safety is to be built on a surveillance network and getting private corporations to become the arbiters of speech, connectivity and human relations, that's a road to tyranny. Like Orwell's Thought Police, the Stasi, the secret police of communist East Germany, were only able to function because eventually one in every three people was an informant. Google, Meta, and Apple won't need to recruit every third person. They'll have AI. Is this how we're going to hand over the running of society to AI? In the name of safety? I think we need to seriously rethink the entire concept of online harm and its causes in a way that doesn't begin by framing it as a content problem and proffering monitoring as a solution.
The first Gulf War with Tony Blair destroyed many people's belief in politics utterly.
Absolutely it did.
What can you say about that kind of shredding of epistemic trust that the online safety bill might be a repeat of?
I wonder whether there's almost something like the equivalent of the supposed adults in the room don't know what they're doing, potentially because the lack of clarity in the online safety bill and the fact that it opens so many back doors into violations of freedoms and privacy, freedom to communicate, freedom, you know, privacy is very important, I think, for functioning minds and for functioning societies. There needs to be that freedom to be able to say what is on one's mind without fear of reprisals. So we've arrived here because technology seems to offer cheap and simple solutions, and human solutions are messy and expensive. And as a society, we might have become lazy. The way our politicians think is lazy. The history of the online safety bill is a kind of proof of that.
For all its choirs of angels, technology is also a devil. We don't get to choose which parts of it are to be preserved because they are good and which parts can be split off and cast away because they're bad. It comes in its entirety. But we can choose how we behave, what values we hold, how we raise and educate children, how we teach, police and care for our children. And these are all human activities, messy, expensive human activities.
We cannot legislate online harm away. We must face the difficult task of reappraising the role of technology in society and face hard questions about our dependency on it and access to it. As I write this, UNESCO and the UN have categorically stated that they think we should ban smartphones for all school-aged children.
Personally, I agree with that. I think phones make kids dumb, but thank God it's not for me to decide on that. My job is just to raise the level of debate and education around these issues.
Snooping on someone else's private communication is against the law. Do we want to carve out digital privilege to allow some anointed people to act against the law with impunity?
Sometimes, yes, in a very, very exceptional circumstances. Sometimes with the approval of a disinterested judge. Sometimes via an open, carefully scrutinised process. And sometimes, like for Lambert's case, when we pay unwitting victims compensation and apologies. But I think we now live in a society of naked double standards, in which the law as written is broken in a normalised way. Our government wants to further erode the rule of law and the rights of citizens in a bid to prop up the teetering technological overreach we're already neck deep in.
Allowing governments to weaken security, mandate back doors, or disrupt end-to-end encryption is unforgivably misguided and unacceptable. The Online Safety Bill attempts to normalise an unacceptable power. The Online Safety Bill aims to do so via a method that will make everyone less secure. As currently written, I think it will ultimately harm more citizens, many of them children, than it protects.
Online safety is desperately needed, but this is not it. Not in its present form. We want a safe online world for our children and for ourselves. Safe from sexual predators and from stalkers and from manipulators and from thieves and data miners who daily fleece us of our intimate lives and stamp all over our dignity. These are also grave harms to our children and are not even mentioned in the so-called online safety bill. Safety for who? Safety from whom or what? Safety to what end?
Yes, we want to be safe from cyber criminals, including those inside our corporations, inside our platform providers, and inside our own government. Governments that are temporarily entrusted by our assent, not by unaccountable quasi-police in corporations we did not elect. Here at The Cyber Show, we will continue to campaign for civic cybersecurity and to educate people towards more sane and noble ends.
So, yeah, on a political as well as a technical note, no thanks to an unworkable technological solution to another insoluble technological problem. A path chosen out of laziness and convenience won't get us to where we need to be. Time for another round of debate and fixes to the bill. As it is, it's clumsy and unworkable.
So it reveals a lack of will to really invest in the law, in law enforcement, in child protection, in real intelligence work, in good parenting, in courageous and loving teaching, in research, in computing and psychology and psychoanalysis, in social science, in addressing the fundamental social factors that make digital technologies harmful in the first place. So boredom, lack of purpose, narcissism, shallow consumerism, alienation and anomie. These are our online harms. And let's not add half-baked draconian legislation to that.
So how do we do that? There's a good chance that the Online Safety Bill will pass in its current degenerate form. This will be a disaster to all of us who want a safer online world. Its subsequent failure will set back progress against online exploitation. How might we tackle this instead? By actually asking all the stakeholders in any vision of a technological society. Governments and corporations, you have consistently proven yourselves very, very bad at determining what is good for people. Fully one third of the conversation, the actual people, are missing. We can do better by creating new jobs in civic cybersecurity, training teachers and social workers, training the police and parents, facing awkward and inconvenient social dynamics. Those that we talk about regularly on this show, by embracing a project of civic cybersecurity. With civic cybersecurity, we can actually make Britain the safest place in the world to be online. Not because its citizens and companies cower under the boot of Big Brother, but because the British people are the smartest, most conscientious, caring, and the most sophisticated users, co-creators of technology in the world, with the highest standards of digital literacy, the highest standard of respect for each other as netizens, and the least social tolerance for abuses of technology, including by governments.
Is it a good idea if the government spies on your messages?
I don't think so. Why would they want to spy on my messages? I haven't got anything interesting to say.
Is privacy important?
Oh, of course, it's important for everybody.
Do you have WhatsApp or Signal?
I have Facebook and I have WhatsApp as well.
Is it okay if the government spy on people's messages?
No, in my opinion.
Is privacy important?
Yes, I think privacy and freedom is very important. I don't think the government should spy on the messages unless they have a very good reason and evidence why they are doing that.
Is it okay for the government to spy on people's messages?
I don't think so, no.
Is it okay if the government spy on people's messages?
No.
Is privacy important for people?
Absolutely.
Even children?
Even more so.
Have you got WhatsApp, Facebook, Signal?
Yeah.
Or Signal?
Yeah.
Is it okay for the government to spy on people's messages?
No.
Is privacy important?
Very.
Yeah, very important.
Even for children?
Of course. Yes.
Especially.
Is it okay for the government to spy on people's messages?
No, not really.
No, no, it shouldn't be.
Is privacy important for people?
Yes, very, yeah.
Even for children?
Especially, yeah, actually.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
Time is gone.